writer. He writes for Information Security Now, so you might have seen his articles there. He's an excellent speaker. And believe it or not, I think 13 years, he was a priest for 13 years. And so he has this magical ability to synthesize ideas and concepts. And I often tell this funny joke about Richard, which he probably hasn't heard. And that is, if I say the stuff that he says, I'll sound like a raving lunatic. But you just listen. When he's talking, he won't sound like a raving lunatic. It'll make sense. And you'll sit there and your brain will expand. And if anybody else was to speak like this, it just doesn't have the authority. And so I think it's his great insight sort of into people and how people relate to reality and how people relate to others around them that makes him such a valuable speaker. So this is your sort of dynamic food for thought over dessert. So with that, Richard Thiem.
Thank you, Jeff. That was a terrific introduction. I said to Noyd, I wish it were true. A lot of people think I'm a raving lunatic. And there's a reason for that. No risk, no reward. And where I try to risk is understanding what's coming and seeing as deeply as possible what's here. And these days, the name of that game is the network. And it has been for a number of years. It has been a privilege. Now, we were just talking again about how much at home we create the homes we need and the homes that feel like home for us, where when you have to go there, they have to take you in, where you can just be truly yourself. And the context created through DEF CON and Black Hat and some of its cousins is that kind of home for me, because it's where people are not afraid to take their thinking to the very edges. Now, what I noticed just from listening to Marcus and to Bruce this morning, again, is that if what you say about computer security is true, then in the rest of the domains of our lives, we are functioning according to a completely obsolete trust model. And I want to use the ancient wisdom of Sun Tzu to get at that. That's kind of like invoking Yoda. Sun Tzu is kind of a mythical figure for us, the way Yoda is. And actually, some of what Yoda said came from Sun Tzu. And I'm going to start with a quote from Sun Tzu. The most important factor in war, he said, is moral influence, by which I mean that which causes the people you lead into battle to be in genuine harmony with their leaders, so they will accompany them unto life and unto death without fear of mortal peril. Now, the network that you described has become the infrastructure of the world in and through which everybody must function today. You cannot avoid functioning in and through the network. The symbiotic relationship between human beings and this sensory extension that you can call the network or the internet or call it by whatever momentary metaphor you want, the symbiotic relationship is now absolute. We have been assimilated. And it began when we began to program the network to think in ways we thought we wanted it to think. And now the network itself, everywhere I go in businesses to do consulting, the network is programming people to think the way the network thinks. You take on a culture and a company, and you take SAP on the other hand, and you tell me which one is going to win the battle for the minds and hearts of the people. SAP is going to win, because if you do not learn to think the way it wants you to think, you cannot function in the symbiotic relationship to which it is necessary. So the symbiotic relationship has already happened. Our identity, and this is the push part at the outset, our very identity as human beings, this is going to get into Blade Runner territory, is determined by our technologies. Our identity is determined by how we come to think of ourselves as possibilities for action in the world, and that comes directly from our technologies. Nietzsche observed long ago that human beings cannot exist without language, and language is a social phenomena. In other words, unless we mirror and exchange information and energy with each other through symbolic networks, in that case language or speech, which grew into writing, which has grown into the net. We literally lose our humanity. Marvin Minsky pointed this out years ago when he said that sooner or later, to not be able to participate meaningfully in the connected network is literally going to be like being raised by wolves in a cave and not speaking the dialect of the tribe. You will be the equivalent of a brain in a bottle, i.e. a desktop computer that is not connected to the internet. So this process, which only a few years ago it sounded prophetic to articulate and predict, is now the context of our lives. Now the flow of information in a system defines by its complexity the nested fractal-like levels of abstraction that make sense. Now somebody is thinking, what the hell did he say? So let me back that up. I find if you repeat things 3 to 4 times, they begin to sound normal. The flow of information, he said. That's obvious. In a system, any system, will determine or define, by virtue of its complexity, the levels of abstraction according to which people function. Let me give you an example. Nation states, what we think of as nations or countries, emerged in the 18th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries in response to technologies of engineering and information. We organized ourselves in ways, which is only very recently in the historical trajectory, that enabled us to govern our social, economic, and political lives, and we called them nation states. We just accepted that as given when you were told where you lived was Canada or the United States or Singapore or wherever it was that you lived as part of your identity. But that identity was determined by a collective level of abstraction that had been engineered by the flow of information in the total global system. Well, the boundaries around that system, around those nation states, it is now becoming a trite saying, are dissolving. It is no longer the nation state in and of itself that compels or commands the kind of loyalty that it used to have because it is disappearing. When I lived in Spain in the 1960s, if I wanted to cross the border into France, I had to get through an outpost manned by the Guardia Civil, and they took their boundary seriously. And they took your running through the boundary quickly, seriously. They would fire. These days, if there's anybody at the border at all, they wave as you pass through because the boundary or border has dissolved. Now they are part of Europe. I subsequently lived in England when they were exchanging pounds, shillings and pence, for pounds and new pence, and now it's for euros. And the simple fact is the level of abstraction by which you come to internalize an identity is given to you by the context in which you live unthinkingly. And the systems of information and the energy that runs through them is the primary determiner of that identity. When a guy named Caxton took the printing press with movable type to England in the 1470s, about a generation after it was invented, the biggest decision they had to make was which of the many equal and competing dialects used in the British Isles they would use for printing material, because the dialect would become the dialect of the larger tribe. And he said, and it could have been said yesterday, when I look back in my childhood and how I thought about reality, he said, it is so different from what is true now that I cannot believe I am in the same place. And in fact, he said, I am not, because now we are learning to become what we call English. Now, for decades now, new global and transglobal entities have determined the economic and political reality in which we live. Let me just use Bechtel as an example. Is anybody not familiar with Bechtel? If you've seen James Bond films, there's usually Ernst Stavro, Blofeld. Well, that's kind of like Bechtel. just use that as an example or metaphor to hold in your mind. You can get information about the agencies of our government using the Freedom of Information Act. You cannot get information about Bechtel using the Freedom of Information Act. You just try to get onto their premises or get into the website. And yet no company, perhaps, is more responsible for building the infrastructure of the world and therefore engineering its political and economic realities than a company like Bechtel. We are in transition from believing we live in countries to recognizing that we live in a network of transglobal entities that we can call global corporations but do not yet really have names that are familiar to us. And that's why it's so easy in the hacking area, that is the true hacking area, the area of penetrating and exploring the network, to posit a Big Brother, 1984 Orwellian-like, as if the real enemy is Big Brother. In fact, there is no Big Brother. The real enemy, as Neal Stephenson said in Computers, Freedom, and Privacy, is never the one we think it is. The true centers of power and those who hold power are not going to reveal their hand or reveal themselves so obviously if they have anything to do about it. Now, that's just background. Now, since 1945, something else has been happening. What we customarily call the intelligence communities have evolved in a way parallel to but separate from the power structures that gave them their original being. Before World War II, we did not have much of an intelligence presence in the world. After, our presence is ubiquitous. Those entities, in the aggregate, regardless of the country of origin, have more in common with one another than they do with the nations that originally spawned them and have evolved their own way of symbiotically relating to one another because they have their own point of reference. Now, what has this resulted in? For some people, the confidence that they know what is going on has completely eroded. The image of the hacker in the popular mind. A hacker is someone who shares with great scientists a passion for knowledge, an obsessiveness that keeps you up all night, night after night, great daring and unconventionality and willingness to cross boundaries in order to know what you need to know in order to build the big picture. This is a truly heroic image because more and more the consensus reality of the nation state is disintegrating. Back to Sun Tzu. The most important factor in war is moral influence and intellectual power, by which I mean that which causes people to be in harmony with their leaders. If people fall out of harmony with their leaders and become cynical and disinterested, which is one of the things that is an inevitable consequence of the disintegration or transformation of economic and social structures, then they will not believe what that entity is telling them, and that entity will not command their loyalty. Timothy Leary, a great hero to many people, once observed, "You can never find out what's happening from the company bulletin or from the adult press. The evolutionary truth, what is really happening, always comes from outcasts." And I know as a consultant that when I go into a company, the best place to get the true picture is from the first person you talk to, a receptionist or a security guard, who people think is doing nothing but hanging around and doing a menial job, but who is in fact observing the entire system and how it really works. Once I was trying to get into a communication company to reach a real person, it took about 2 weeks to get through voicemail. When I finally got a person on the phone, I exploded and I said, "You know, you're a communication company, and you're really not getting it right." And she said, "You're right. We made a big mistake. We fired way too many people, way too fast. And you know what we found out?" she said. I said, "What?" She said, "We found out the people are the network. We thought we could just plug new people into the network, but the modular learning that each human component, in effect," she said, "had could not be replaced or easily imitated. And therefore, we had sabotaged the network ourselves by causing it to dysfunction by getting rid of too many people too fast." As soon as she kicked me upstairs to her supervisor and I repeated what she said, he said, "That's ridiculous. She had no right to say that. That's not what happened." The higher you go up the hierarchical ladder, the more the allegiance to the fictional or mythical truth of the corporation or entity. And therefore, the truth is usually told at the lowest levels where somebody has infinite time to observe and no negative downside for simply telling you the truth. Okay, so the MAP itself is dissolving. I'm just trying to make this point. To secure an electronic network, even to secure its perimeter absolutely, and to build concentric rings of increasingly air-gapped networks inside those networks, if you ignore the larger trusted network of human beings that come and go as they please, is not going to accomplish anything really if the purpose of securing the network is to secure the knowledge that the network holds or contains. In other words, the kinds of seminars, workshops, keynotes you're going to attend to conferences like this are in part designed to reinforce the belief that securing the electronic perimeter will secure the entity that is at risk. And yet, all you hear in the hallways, I mean, how many bulletin boards are out there for resumes? I mean, how many people are looking for a new job? Everybody, nobody. It's the most fluid work environment that has ever existed in the world. And so can you take the head of the person? Can you take their proprietary knowledge? Can you really constrain it and keep it when they leave? I don't think so. So how do you secure the larger network? That's what I mean by nested levels, the fractal-like nested levels, from the electronic network up to the human beings that it represents and who must be maintained. Well, when people interact with computers, they always project onto them the qualities of human beings. I love a study once done on teamwork in which they took a computer and put a red band around it and then gave a group of people a red armband to work with and said, you and that computer are one team. And then they took another group and they gave them a blue band around the computer and a blue armband, you're one team. And then they did evaluations of the efficacy of the computers afterward, the networks, and they found out that those who used the red computer and were on the red team thought it had, you know, it was faster processor, more user-friendly, did a much better job, etc. In other words, you immediately project onto the members of your team qualities of leadership. They're smarter, they're faster. This must be an ancient, deep, primordial, tribal projection that we did. And yet, if you don't know to what group you really belong, or to what your loyalty is ultimately going, how can you function the way Sun Tzu said both leaders and followers have to function? All warfare, Sun Tzu said, is based on deception. Warfare today is global, ubiquitous, and unceasing. Warfare is the state of being of power entities on our planet. Therefore, what we call wars traditionally are merely weapons in war. The way Vietnam was lost was a victory. Only now, a generation later, is Vietnam being allowed to begin to approach, hat in hand, the global economic community in order to find its way. The lesson of Vietnam is that the punishment still belonged to those who could isolate and neutralize what had looked like a victor. Hanging the heads of the vanquished and the victim on spikes at the cities of the global gate is exactly the kind of advice you heard from Marcus this morning in terms of dealing with hackers / terrorists / script kiddies. The fusion of mass media and disinformation and political surveillance and social control and entertainment and infotainment and global corporate interests, I wrote, is nearly absolute. We live inside a simulated circus in which the images of the wild animals are all around us, but they insulate us from the real harm of simulation itself. Sun Tzu said, you must know yourself and you must know the mind of the enemy, because all strategy is directed at the mind of the enemy. And Sun Tzu wrote extensively about the use of spies, counter-spies, surveillance, and intelligence networks. He saw that war was something created in the minds of the enemy and the victor alike, and that the person who could manipulate the images of power could break the will of someone else to fight. I've used this as an example before because I think it illustrates so well who holds the power in the world. When the United States was fighting in Somalia, our will to fight was broken ultimately not by any actual battle, because our firepower was overwhelming, but by an image of Rangers being dragged through the streets, surrounded by the cheering enemy. In other words, the weapon that fired the final shot was a 30-second video clip. Now, I know that some of you are here who were there or who knew people who were there, so you have a good sense of whether that clip was real. But most of the audiences I ask have no idea whether, in fact, that video clip was real. We never again made the mistake we made in Vietnam of letting people with cameras get up close. Those of you who have seen the pictures from the Gulf War, have seen the horrific images of destruction and death, know that they have never been shown in the circuitous wraparound surround sound environment which manipulates how we think of ourselves and our very identities. The expert said Sun Tzu, like a good hacker, leaves no trace. He is mysterious, inaudible, invisible, and therefore, he said, he is the master of the enemy's fate. Those who control the images that are internalized as if they are we ourselves and control, therefore, how we construct our identities, those are the people who control the power in the global war that is ongoing, unceasing, and ubiquitous. And therefore, to lock down the network only at the electronic level, without simultaneously revolutionizing the trust model according to which human beings function, is to leave open all of the city gates while locking shut all of its windows. Okay. Let me give you an example. Now, Operation Paperclip was started in 1945. I'll make this very quick and brief. Operation Paperclip was an effort to bring to this country various German scientists to assist in the war effort over here. Some news leaked out about that several decades later, and we were told that Operation Paperclip lasted 1945, 46, 47, and then ended. In fact, it went on at least until 1973 under its real form, in which numerous scientists were brought over from Germany to the United States, not only to build rockets, because it was easy to be heroic about going to the moon, but also to conduct biological and chemical warfare. And some of the people brought over turned out to be people who really were war criminals who had conducted such experiments in camps like Dachau or had administered the slave labor camps like Dora that built the V-2 rockets. Their past was expunged, their histories were rewritten, and hundreds of them were brought in to work in our research projects in government, in universities, and in American corporate life. They were protected and they were secured, and it was contrary to presidential directive and contrary to the law. The point I'm simply making is that there was a chessboard once upon a time with which many of us middle-aged people grew up, and it had mythological characters on it. World War II was full of mythology in which not Germans but Nazis were the archetype of evil, and therefore that which we opposed made us good. But in fact, the discovery of operations like Paperclip, which are commonplace, says that the mythology was completely incorrect. That in fact, we did not hold against Nazi scientists who had conducted horrific medical experiments what they had done. What we did was grant them immunity and bring them over in order to use them in our own programs, where some of them continued to exercise tests, although not of the same magnitude, on unsuspecting enlisted men in our armed forces, in the same way that we granted immunity and gave a pass to the people who spearheaded Unit 731 in Japan from 1932 to 1945, which experimented terrifically and horrifically on thousands of prisoners, including prisoners of war from this country, many of whom were vivisected, i.e. cut open alive, in order to determine the effectiveness of the toxins and chemicals that were used on them. Everyone was granted immunity in order to get the data. Now, I don't want to depress anybody. I just want to say that if you live with that reality, either you become hard-nosed and realistic, and you live in Chinatown, where nobody knows what's going on in Chinatown. But if you want to live according to the identity that once gave form, structure, possibility, and purpose to your being, then you need to have a chessboard that is not dissolving quite so rapidly. You need to know who is who And in the digital world, the nested levels of construction of identity are no longer in our own hands. So you may think you know the name of the corporation for which you work. The purpose of this talk is simply to say you don't and you can't. At a place recently where I gave a talk to senior investment people, another speaker discussed the emergence of a transglobal sector of stocks that had to be tracked as if they were a totally different entity. And he was just giving testimony to what I'm saying, that the emergent realities of the digital world are giving birth to new entities. He called them transglobal, but what he meant is that there are companies, oil companies, for example, that literally are not grounded in any particular country, do not live here and have branches there, but genuinely float above the whole world, creating a new transglobal structure, and we don't know yet how to give names to that kind of social or economic or political structure. We are living according to identities that were created by the printing press with movable type, and yet the digital world is causing us to have to watch them disappear before our very eyes. Therefore, when you are mobilizing the troops in leadership, according to Sun Tzu, if you simultaneously must command their loyalty and also be a master of deception, it was presumed that you were deceiving the enemy and that you were commanding the loyalty of your own troops by sincerity. That's the paradox. Because if we don't know who is the enemy, and if we habitually use the manipulations of mass digital deception on ourselves, which generates cynicism and ultimately disinterest on the part of the troops, i.e. us, then how can anyone be led, and into what battle will they be led? The digital world is interactive, it is modular, and it is fluid. It is creating for us the capability of creating our own identities, modular-like, out of the pieces of our lives and reinventing ourselves again and again and again. I've done that with my life. And I'm aware that it's the digital world that gives me that power. We are formed in the image of our technologies, in other words. And modular identities mean we have to know most basically and essentially who we truly are in order to create these identities again and again in a serial fashion, and then how to manipulate the personas in order to have credibility so that it makes sense to other people when we speak. If anything I am saying makes sense, it's because at some level you know I am describing a deeply true and deeply uncomfortable truth that makes securing the digital network itself the easy part. For what purpose, I am asking, are you securing the network? What is the ultimate goal or intention or aim or trajectory of the images and symbols of meaning that travel across the network? Who has their hands on those throttles of power? What are they ultimately going to do with those images? And to what degree, to those of you who determine the hardware and software, i.e. the form of those images and symbols, to what degree are you entering into either agreement or collusion with their ultimate purposes? And then we had better know what it is. The antidotes to the threats I've described are two. One is to keep creating in collusion these kinds of infotainment worlds made up of digital images which people subsequently believe, and which, when they are conflicted with images like Operation Paperclip, cause despair, or to seize once again the hacker passion for truth, knowledge, obsessiveness, and daring in order to build the bigger picture according to points of reference that we can recreate in a global transplanetary culture and then all share again, knowing who we are coming out of the planet Earth. 5 years ago, I spoke at DEF CON, and I called it hacking as practice for transplanetary culture in the 21st century. I know when I talk about transplanetary culture, alien civilizations, our interaction with other civilizations, it sounds crazy. Robert Galvin, Motorola, when asked what ideas were the breakthrough ideas for Motorola from the beginning, said everyone began its life as a minority opinion, and it was not heard. Or if it was heard, it was ridiculed, and no one agreed with it until finally it was said enough that finally everyone agreed they had believed it all along. That's when you know it's become consensus reality, and by the time it is something that everybody knows, I can tell you it is no longer true. The world of computer security is not what it looks like from the way we talk about it here. Computer security in the world that is just coming, the emergent realities of embedded electronic communications that we wear, that are threaded through us, the genetic engineering in which we engage in order to enhance or augment our sensory extensions or our minds or thinking, the Blade Runner world in which memories are implants, and in fact memories are already implants created by the digital global media. That is the world in which security will mean getting a hold of the memories themselves or creating the genes and splicing the chemicals in that will create the kinds of memories we want, no different than the kinds of biological and chemical experiments we have been doing for several generations. Oh, I see I have to stop. I would like to take that one out. I'd like to go out as far as I could with it, because what is right there when you talk to the people doing the cutting-edge research, transplanetary culture, genetic engineering, and new modalities of communication and information that are worn, are in us, are embedded in us, and are all around us. This is going to create a security, an entirely different world, an entirely different challenge, because the very definition of what it means to be a human being is going to be changed at the moment we begin to wrestle with those real issues. I'm just trying to give you something to think about as you move from seminar to seminar, as you go back to your work. The big picture is so much bigger than we dare to know. Somehow find a moment to keep it in mind, constantly question your ultimate loyalties, and look at what securing the network is really securing and on whose behalf. I have no answers, but as long as I'm alive, I want to just keep asking questions. Thank you very, very much for your attention. Thanks.